know how you know they're gonna be there and we are in the same class, I said, wow.
Like UNC will get, yeah, UNC wants to have applications all over. Is why you need to be.
I have my next. That's.
Now that's, no, that's the day it has to get in pass. Originally, they said it was that day it has to get back there.
I just like, why, and I just.
No, it's kind of like changes, like their deadlines and now like the end of the line.
I love you. I love you.
Okay, so thank you. Look at your application.
Yeah, so much.
UNC, you can do it electronically.
Sorry, wait, but she can't work as much?
Yeah. That I was.
Are y'all looking to work?
By the state, I was able to.
Yeah. I'm on my way. Jamie's working Monday, Thursday, Friday, and I'm working Monday.
Or they would send the cheese, but kind of lady, or I had to get mail to myself, those things. There, you can get mail anywhere, but like.
I have three labs.
Do you?
Three labs. Yeah, one lab is possibly, and then another lab is possibly. I have four classes.
See, they wouldn't do that, but they.
You have three labs.
Things I have. And it is.
I get out of it all that, but you know, on the next, because I have plant biology. What is that, wave? What is?
Microwave?
Oh, I get it now. I've never seen that. It's a good idea though.
Okay, let's begin. So today we start with our first real hardcore thermodynamic. Well, maybe not hardcore, but today we're going to start with thermodynamics, and this is going to make up about the first third of the class. And so the way the course is structured is we take the first third is sort of classical thermo. The middle third has to do a little bit with binding and protein interactions. And the final third has to do with kinetics and rates of reactions. And so in that sense, you're really getting the same amount of coverage on chemical topics as you would in a standard, you know, first semester PChem class. And so if any of you guys are so motivated or inclined to take second semester PChem, you're welcome to. This will count towards your, I guess it's not technically a prerequisite anymore, but it covers essentially the same material, maybe if not in the same level of mathematical depth. So we did last week, and we talked about protein structure, a little bit about protein function, because it gives us a context to understand, you know, the problems that we'll be dealing with the rest of the semester. But the problems that we're going to be dealing with are going to have to do with, you know, protein A interacts with protein B, or some salt molecule binds to a particular protein. And so you guys need to understand what a protein is or have some conceptual view of what that is, even if the question is inherently thermodynamic and would probably be treated just as easily with, you know, sodium nitrate dissolves in water, what's the heat of solubility or the heat of dissolution or something like that. So in that sense, we're actually covering, I mean, I don't think we're covering more material, but the supplemental math that's covered in a standard PChem class in this class is replaced with the understanding of protein DNA systems, biological reactions, and things like that. But we still have to cover the same kinds of thermodynamics. And so, like it or not, this is where we sort of jump into standard thermo, and it does get mathy, so that's what we're going to be looking at a little bit today. We'll try to keep it somewhat tame for you guys so it doesn't get overwhelming. But there's going to be a little bit of a shift between this week and last week. Any questions on what we covered last week as far as protein structure? I know a couple of you have stopped by office hours and asked questions on the homework, so that's good. I mean, people are starting it. Okay. Hopefully most of you noticed that I do post the lecture slides up before lecture. You're welcome to print those out and work along. Although I also, I have notes that I work from too, and so you can't just exclusively use the lecture slides, and particularly when I have some equations in lecture slide format, but I also like to write some down on the board. Generally, when you're seeing a derivation on the board, it's not going to be something that you're tested on. You might receive extra credit or something if you know it. And so if you miss something, it's not generally going to be something really critical unless I say this is critical. If that happens and you want to catch up on something, or you just not sure that you have something in your notes correct, just stop by. I can go over it with you. I resist the temptation to put these notes online. One, because sometimes I make mistakes, but two, it also encourages you guys to follow along. And if I just released everything to the world, then there wouldn't be a whole lot of reason for you guys to be here, and I think there is something beneficial about being in class. Okay, so we're going to start our discussion on thermodynamics with a very simple thought experiment, maybe not the most creative thought of experiments, but you all have blenders at home, or at least those of you who like to make mixed drinks have blenders at home, and presumably you've all used it to a certain extent to either crush ice or make some sort of soup, whatever, make milkshakes, whatever you want to do with it. But suppose you take your blender and you fill it up with some water. And before you do anything, you measure the temperature of the water. So probably the water coming out of your tap is going to be around 20 degrees Celsius, plus or minus. And then you turn that blender on for 5 minutes, and then you measure the temperature again. Hopefully it's intuitive at this point that the temperature in that blender, or the water in the blender, is going to go up, right? So we've taken our blender, we've done a whole bunch of work, and we observe the second temperature, and we see the second temperature go up. But the question that thermodynamics has to do with, and the question that the original thermodynamicists were interested in, is why does this happen? People back in the 1800s didn't need blenders to observe this. And you would notice a significant increase in temperature if you did this at home. But people just paddling around with an oar or a spoon in a cup of water, that's also sufficient to raise the temperature of the water. And so early scientists back in the 1800s were looking at this type of phenomena, and they were trying to come up with an explanation for how these things worked and what are the specific properties of matter that allows energy to be transferred somehow from stirring or shaking water to the point where now the water has a higher temperature. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Okay, good. So, what did early scientists have? Thermodynamics is not a terribly new science. There's new developments in it all the time, but thermodynamics really dates back to the 1800s, and so these guys basically had the ability to measure things like temperature, density, mass, volume. They could measure electrical currents in some cases. They could do, I guess they could measure mass. So they were fairly limited in the types of measurements they could do, and they didn't have a very firm understanding of the atomic nature of masses. And so all of our understanding about chemical bonds, Brownian motion, things that we probably take more or less for granted today, these guys were basically still trying to figure out what's the structure of an atom. Does it have a nucleus? This is the same time period that you were thinking about, plum pudding versus Bohr versus, Bohr came much later, but the different types of models for what an atom is. And so the thermodynamicists were trying to do something quite bold, right? I mean, they're trying to take this very molecular property of trying to understand temperature increases and the relationship to energy, and they were doing it without a molecular framework that you guys have basically had since you were in high school. And so in that sense, it's kind of interesting what they were doing. And they came up with this concept of thermodynamics. And so thermodynamics, if you look at the word, thermo generally means heat. Dynamics generally means, you know, transfer or motion from one thing to another. And so the field that these early scientists came up with was the study of essentially heat transfer. Okay, so now we'll see it also has a lot to do with something called energy too, but ultimately thermodynamics was originally probed and investigated by studies of temperature, because temperature was something that people could measure. And so when we think about how heat is transferred, or equivalently how energy is converted, right? So just like we converted our energy from rotational sort of blade motion in the blender to thermal energy in the example before, we can also envision other types of examples of energy conversion. One of which, from your physics classes, it's a popular one, you know, if you push in or pull out on a spring, you're taking that force that you have, and you're converting the force from your arms or from your hands into stored potential energy in the spring. And so you're converting from a physical force to something that's stored in the spring itself. And in the spring, again, thinking molecularly, that's stored in bonds and other types of molecular aspects of the spring. But again, they're just, you know, they didn't know that. They're just saying, I'm storing energy in the spring. And so that's one type of energy conversion. If you have a computer at home or in your book bag and you turn it on for a while, you'll notice your computer starts to get hot. Okay, it's not like there's a fire in your computer, is there? So you're converting the electrical energy from either the battery or from the current from the wall into thermal heat that's being then blown out the side of the computer. And so electricity is being converted into heat there, similar to the blender. Something, again, you're all familiar with from your general and organic chemistry is, but when you break and reform bonds, you have the energy of formation. As far as talking about, you know, how much energy is needed or given off when a bond forms or when a bond breaks. So there you're taking that energy and you're storing it in something called a chemical bond. So a bond stores energy in the same way that a spring stores energy when you push on it. Okay, so there's all sorts of examples of energy conversion, and realistically all of these examples, you know, they're not just relevant to chemistry, although that's what we're interested in this class, but they're relevant to physics. You know, you talk about galaxy formation or how does a star form or how does a star die. Physicists are very interested in thermodynamics. You know, all sorts of engineering principles, and somebody trying to make a motor or a more efficient engine for a car, they're obviously going to want to know some thermodynamics. And so it's relevant to pretty much every field of science. And we're going to see in this class how it's relevant to biology and chemistry. But the reason why thermodynamics is still around is because it's extremely useful in lots and lots of different situations. Okay, so I've told you essentially when thermodynamics was being developed that the people who were doing it didn't necessarily have a firm understanding of the molecular properties of matter. And so you could probably think, and maybe some of you who are thinking about this said, well, why did we spend the whole last week learning about protein and DNA, because that's essentially exquisite molecular detail that probably isn't really needed for understanding thermodynamics. Well, that's true. I will concede that point in a sense. And so if we think about our friends, you know, William Thomson, who's Lord Kelvin, and Josiah Willard Gibbs, who's another famous thermodynamicist, you could say, well, Lord Kelvin didn't need molecules. Why should I need molecules? And realistically, when these guys were doing their science, you know, quantum mechanics, Einstein first proposed the basic ideas behind quantum mechanics in the early 1900s. That was when, you know, quantization of angular momentum and the Bohr model of the atom first was proposed. So think early 1900s. So quantum mechanics and an understanding of chemical bonds is way off, right? So, and in fact, you know, kinetic theory, the idea that, you know, matter is formed of molecules that are bouncing around against each other and you know, forming atomic collisions, that was still in its infancy as well. And so in that sense, there wasn't a whole lot of understanding. But if you understand what's going on with the molecules, it can make the thermodynamics much, much more intuitive. Okay, and so we'll see an example of that this week when we start thinking about heat capacity and what does heat capacity actually measure. Okay, so you can say, well, molecular reasoning makes thermodynamics more intuitive. Thermodynamics can be very hard to understand, and so anything that we can get to understand it better can be very useful to us. And specifically when you're talking about binding, you know, it's easy to think about a protein binding a nucleic acid or a protein binding a protein. That's something that you can wrap your head around rather than this has an equilibrium constant and delta G is this, and if I change delta G, it's just, you know, it's easier to think about specific type of molecular interactions rather than just thinking about, you know, chemical species. Although really all you need is just to recognize that there's different chemical states of matter. But then also, if we try to understand, you know, which interactions are important. So for example, how do I quantify you know, whether an electrostatic interaction between two charges is more important than a hydrogen bond, for example? How would I measure that? Well, that's a thermodynamic question. And so understanding the thermodynamics from a molecular point of view lets you answer some of those questions. It lets you say, okay, well, in this case, electrostatics is probably the dominant contribution to this delta G. Or in this case, hydrogen bonds probably make up the dominant part of this delta G. So if you're thinking about all this stuff that you guys learned in Gen Chem, having the molecular understanding makes it a little bit easier. But then the thermodynamics informs the molecular understanding as well. Okay, so now that we've sort of outlined the basis of thermodynamics and what we're talking about, we need to establish definitions. So last week we said, you know, there are a couple of cases where understanding what secondary structure is, understanding a nucleotide versus a nucleoside is, you know, having the vocabulary makes you at least more intelligible as a scientist. So thermodynamics has its own set of definitions that for better or for worse, we all sort of need to memorize and know. Many of these will be review. Some will not, but there's some useful mnemonics that you can use to remember the ones that might be unfamiliar to you. The first thing that we need to distinguish is a system versus a surrounding. So this goes all the way back to your Gen Chem 2 class, I think, where you have a system, which is the part of the universe that you're studying. So generally, as scientists, we're interested in looking at a particular type of reaction, or maybe some sort of reaction vessel, or maybe we're looking at some solution or some piece of matter. And so that's going to form the system, the thing that we're interested in, the thing that we're studying. Whereas the surroundings, as you might imagine, are pretty much everything else. Okay, and so everything else includes not only the local surroundings. So for example, if this alarm clock is my system, then the surroundings would obviously include this plastic tub, the desk, the air around the alarm clock, but in reality, the surroundings would include the entire universe, right? So everything, and that's why I have all the way up here to Jupiter, right? So if I'm doing a reaction in the lab next door, technically the surroundings include this classroom, although some might be more relevant than others. Like, you know, normally when I'm talking about heat transfer, I'm not going to see an effect on Jupiter if I mix two chemicals together in my lab. And so that, if I do eventually see an effect on Jupiter, hopefully I'm not doing anything that dramatic, it would take a little time, and the immediate effect would be in my lab, and so I wouldn't have to worry about Jupiter so much. And then the area between the systems and the surroundings is called the boundary. And so when somebody talks to you about a boundary condition or a boundary limitation, they're usually saying that there's some property of the boundary that has to remain fixed over time. And so if you're solving an equation or some sort of situation for your system, you have those limits on the end that, you know, for example, temperature has to be continuous. You can't have an instantaneous jump in temperature over zero displacement. So there's always a little bit of a temperature gradient between even your hot cup of coffee in your hand or something like that. So generally the boundary is strictly a geometric problem, but sometimes it can be important in solving a problem thermodynamically. So we can also define different types of systems. So for an example, an isolated system would be a system with no mass or energy exchange with the surroundings. Obviously some of these are rather ideal, and you can't necessarily get at them in all cases, but a model of an isolated system might be a sealed glass container, right? So where you have if the glass is tinted or something like that, there's no energy that can come out or come in from the sun or from light. And the glass, because it's sealed, it keeps all of the air and the vapor and everything in the glass tube sealed in there, so there's no mass exchange either. So that would be one example. You could imagine others involving, calorimeters or specially designed materials, but an isolated system has no exchange of energy or mass. We're not generally interested in studying isolated systems because there's not a whole lot going on. Oftentimes the interesting thing is the exchange between the system and the surroundings or vice versa. Although one of the main postulates of reality is that we're living in an isolated system, right? We assume that the universe is all there is, and that whereas there's no exchange between the universe as far as energy and something else. And so by living in the universe, we're in an isolated system. Now, energy can be transferred to and fro, but we're not transferring energy outside of the universe somehow. We can also define a closed system, which has no exchange of mass, but we can exchange heat. So this would be pretty easy to construct examples where we have, an engine where, there's no real mass being exchange from your engine, but as the engine heats up, you can heat up the environment. Although depending on your exhaust, there's probably some mass that's going out there too. You imagine a coffee cup, which you have on your assignment, where your coffee cup, you can more or less assume that there's no transfer of mass, it's just transferring heat to the surroundings. Obviously, if you count vapor pressure and evaporation, yes, there's some change of mass, but over a reasonable stretch of time, it's not changing. And then an open system can obviously exchange both. And so they're all bets are off, and you have to take into account everything. Okay. So questions on what we discussed as far as definitions at this point? Okay, so now we're going to talk a little bit about work and heat. And the goal of this class is to get us up to the first law of thermodynamics at the end. And so disregard the slide. We'll get to that in a second. But for now, we're talking about work and some examples of work. So we have a convention. And it's important to memorize this convention because it makes things a little bit easier to understand later on. But our convention, if we're going to give work a number, then we can have positive work, negative work. And our convention is that work done to the system by the surroundings, ostensibly, is positive. Okay, so if I do 5 joules of work to this alarm clock, then in my equations, I need to represent, because I'm the system and I'm the surroundings and the alarm clock is the system, that would be represented as positive work, so plus 5 joules. Okay, and similarly, work done by the system on the surroundings is negative. So if this alarm clock actually secretly houses some sort of explosive device and it blows up and throws me across the room, then that work done by the alarm clock would be negative because it's doing work on the surroundings. Okay, and so it's important to remember this convention because if you mess up the sign and you're adding different types of work together and you use the wrong sign for one and the right sign for the other, then you're going to sort of get a cancellation effect and you'll get the wrong answer. And generally on your homework assignments or exams, I'm going to be looking for what's the sign of the work that you're giving me. Is it appropriate to the way the system has been designed? Okay, so that's our convention for work. If you go back to your physics classes, you'll have that there's a definition for work too. So work, which in this class will almost be always be represented by W, is equal to some force times some displacement, delta x. Okay, so if I have a constant force that I'm applying to some object, and I move that constant force some distance x, then I'm performing some amount of work times, which is equal to the force times the distance x. Now, if the force is changing over time, or the displacement is in multiple dimensions, then this equation is going to get more complicated. And if you remember back to your real physics, depending on if you had calculus-based physics, your calculus equation would be the integral of f dot dx. But we're not going to worry about that for now. This is sort of the main equation that we're talking about when we think about work. Okay, so it's the product of force along a path. If I move a box from point A to point B, so this is displacement, delta x, and there's some frictional force that I'm working against to push that box, then all it is the force of friction times a displacement. So that's essentially what work is. It's not really much more complicated than that, although you can write more complicated mathematical expressions.
So it's not the force that you push the box through?
Is it
that minus?
So if you push the box at constant velocity, you are applying a force that is being opposed by the force of friction. Oh. So the force that you're applying is what's actually displacing the box.
So you're accounting for that?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Now, if you were accelerating the box, that would be a little bit of a different situation because your force might
you know, depending on what's happening with the friction, might change. But generally, if you're working with constant forces, constant displacements, it's just the product of the two. Okay, so as an example, and this, I apologize, goes a little bit back into physics. We have a piston and some sort of mass that's sitting on the ground. So the situation envisioned here is if I have the ground, and maybe I'm taking my car to the mechanic shop and they're trying to lift it up off the ground. So there's some sort of piston there, and it's moving the box, which my car would weigh a lot more than 10 kilograms, but it's moving it from the ground up to 10 meters off the ground, right? So the question is, how much work does it do to move the box from the ground to 10 meters off the ground? So here again, when we're thinking about a system like this, it helps us to define what's the system, what's the surroundings. And so for this type of problem, who wants to propose a system for us? Why would you choose the piston? So the piston is doing the work, but what's it doing the work to? The mass. Okay, so what were you going to say? So when you're thinking about setting up your system and surroundings, you're thinking about what's getting the work done to it. And so in this situation from our convention, it helps to know what our convention is, because if we think of work done to the system, something is doing the work, right? And so from that point of view, you can think, well, what's doing the work here? Well, you can think of the piston as doing the work, and if it's doing the work to something, then the something that it's doing the work to has to be the system itself. Okay, so our system would be the box, and then the surroundings would primarily be the piston, but would be technically everything else. Does that make sense? Okay, anybody have a problem with me? Okay, you can have a problem with me, I'm okay. We can debate thermodynamics and hopefully we'll both learn something. Okay, so now that we've just specified what's the system, what's the surroundings, we'll draw that with our arrows. System, surroundings. Does anybody remember what the force is? Mass times acceleration. Okay, so our force in this case is mass times acceleration, or in this case we're going to say, what's the acceleration due to gravity? Is that, how's that typically represented? 9.8 meters per second squared, or the small letter g. So, right? And in this case, the force pushes down, right? So the weight of the object pushes against the piston. And so the piston has to do work against that force, right? Okay, so if our force is equal to mass times g, that's going to be 10 kilograms times 9.8 meters per second squared, as some of you already said. So we're going to get 98 kilogram meters per second squared, which is 98 newtons. Although we're just going to leave it as kilograms meter per second squared for now. And thinking about the direction of motion, that force goes down. And in our case, I think it's convenient to define down as a negative direction, right? So we'll give that a negative sign. Again, remembering our coordinate system. So if the force pushes down, it's negative. If it's up, it's positive. Okay? And so now we have our work equation, which is work is F times delta X. So the absolute value of delta X is 10, right? 10 meters. Does that point, or is that positive or negative in our convention? It's positive because it's up. So the force is down and the direction is up, and so they're working against each other. So we can write 98 kilogram meters per second squared times 10 meters. And so we're left with minus 980 kilogram meters squared per second squared, which if you look at your units, that's defined as 1 joule. Or that's defined as 980 joules. Okay. Is this zero significant? No. Okay. Yes, because we just put, you know, one significant digit on our 9.8. Yeah. Yes.
And the work is being done to the system, right?
Work is being done to the system, that's correct.
Why is it not positive?
So that's a very good question. So we're going to get to that. And so this is where you have to think, right? So the work done from a physics point of view is negative. But what was our perspective when we talked about pushing up versus the force against the piston, right? So this is work done against the piston. So this is essentially, we've written our work in terms of the surroundings, not the system itself, because we've formulated this equation in terms of the piston. But it's very keen to observe that the work done to the systems has to be positive, and so in this sense, we know that we need to flip the sign when we report our final answer. Okay, now some of you don't believe me. I'm looking at Jenica and she's like, "You're full of it, Dr. Fitzke." Okay, so let's go over this again. So when we established our coordinate system, we said the force is being applied by the piston itself, correct? Okay, and so if the piston is applying the force, is the piston the system or the surroundings? The piston is the surroundings.
What?
I answered another question.
So remember the system is the box, the piston is the surroundings, right? Right? So we've solved this equation in terms of the piston. So when we say that the, and so this is where you have to remember what's your system, what's your surroundings. If the piston's work is negative, then the system's work is positive. So we could just as easily flip our system around and say our system is the piston and the surroundings is the box. Right? This is why it's so important to specify what is the system, what is the surroundings. Anything done to the system by the surroundings must equal anything done by the system to the surroundings, but they have to be negative. Right? So there's an inverse relationship between the two. And so what we've done by focusing on the piston is we've solved it where the piston is now our system. And so in that sense, work done by the system is negative makes perfect sense because the piston is actually doing the work. But at the very beginning of our question, we said, well, we want our box to be our system, which means that if we report our final answer, it has to be positive. Okay? And so you could have, and maybe we should have just followed through on our initial temptation to say the system is going to be the piston. because that would have made sense. And in your problem sets or in any kind of solution, I mean, you know, we're not going to talk to this kind of much detail. And for consistency, I'll usually say this is going to be the system in a homework assignment. But for your own sanity, you have to establish at the beginning of the problem what your system and surroundings are. And then when you get to your answer, you need to make sure, does this make sense knowing what I know about the system?
So I understand what you're saying. This is the question's word, and how much work does it do? Would you put it as negative? Because you're talking about the work that the force did. I understand how it would say which one's which. It's just hard to know which you want to do.
I think that's a good point. I didn't notice that from last year. I think how much work does it do? I think it sort of implicitly assumes that the piston is the system.
How much work is done on the mask? How much work?
So I think you have a good point.
So if that last sentence said how much work does the piston do, would you leave it negative?
Yeah.
But if it said how much work does the mask do, you make it positive.
You would make it positive. Because the mass, if that's the system, then it's not doing work, it's having good work done to it. Yeah, I think, yes and no. I mean, you could easily imagine, I mean, it really depends on convention. Because I could have just as easily worded the problem so that it could be positive or negative, depending on the wording. Yeah.
When you started doing all the formulas and stuff, you used the mass of the box. So, like, why did that come out to be the work done by the system, by the surroundings, if you're using numbers from the system?
Because that's what the piston actually has to lift. Okay, so the piston, I mean, the piston needs to push something.
Okay.
And that's where it's pushing against the body. So. Yeah, Danielle.
Could you not technically just make the initial mass times gravity force positive, because essentially that's implying that the force itself is the mass times gravity, whereas the piston is actually just matching that and going upwards.
You could do that too, yes, because that's where the direction of the force is pushing against the, you know, the force is pushing up, because that's where the piston is pushing, and the displacement is also up. So yes, you could do that too. But again, this is sort of the more traditional physics way to do it. Because the physicists with the free body diagrams, they want you to draw a coordinate system and get everything set up. Now, fortunately, you know, don't feel bad if this isn't, you know, 100% intuitive. Most of this class, we're not going to be working with pistons and masses, right? We're going to be working with chemicals and things like that. On the other hand, we're going to get to another example here in a second, which we will spend a lot of time on, which is somewhat related, but a little bit more easy just to compartmentalize and give a nice clear rule to, where we're talking about gas expanding in a cylinder. Okay, and so you remember your ideal gas equation fondly? Yeah, so a good bit of this first section of our class is going to be working with ideal gases and how they behave. Now, who knows why we care about ideal gases?
So we use that to predict the behavior of similar but non-redundant.
Okay, but why do we care? I mean, we're thinking about chemicals in solution, right? Why do we care about ideal gases if we're interested in
they produce gases?
They can produce gases, so in that case, it's good. That's actually pretty insightful, but it's getting to where we need to be, but it's not quite there. So yes, if I put some sodium and chloride in water, just like a gas isn't going to change its consistency or whatever, an ideal gas, that sodium and chloride in water is not going to change its consistency. But what we're going to work towards, and hopefully, I think I might call it like the most important lecture of your lives as chemists, is we're going to see that the behavior of ideal gases has been used and is used to model the behavior of any kind of chemical species in solution. And so if you think about an ideal gas and how it behaves under compressibility situations, you could say, well, that's sort of like how, a salt molecule or a sodium chloride or benzene behaves in a solution of toluene, right? So if I have a gas where I'm looking at, water vapor bouncing around the cylinder, that's sort of like how a benzene molecule behaves when it's bouncing around in solution. And so, we'll get to the actual theoretical reason why that is, but that's why we're talking about ideal gases. So whenever I say ideal gas, you can think, molecules in solution. I don't want to spoil the punchline, but lest you think that this is totally irrelevant. So let's think about our cylinder. See if I have a slide here. Okay, yep. So we have our gas. It has a pressure, P, and it's stored in some sort of round cylinder. The top of the cylinder is airtight, so it's this typical ideal gas cylinder question. Airtight cylinder, it can expand or contract. There's no friction between the piston and the cylinder itself. And so we're interested in how much work can our gas do as it expands or contracts. Okay, so essentially, under our initial condition, we have our cylinder. Inside the cylinder is a gas with P1 pressure and V1 volume. The cylinder has a cross-sectional area of A, right? And then there's some external pressure. Maybe that's being applied, maybe my hand's sitting on top of the cylinder. But it could also be, just vapor pressure from the surroundings. And so this is the initial state. And then the final state now our gas has expanded a little bit by a delta X. Okay, so this is going to be P2 and okay, I think that's good. Okay, so we have some stuff here that we recognize, right? That delta X is probably, that's screaming at us. Oh, there's got to be some way to put that into a work equation, right? But as far as the other stuff, we're not seeing a whole lot. I don't see an obvious force for certain. And, if I want to try to get a work here, it's probably not going to be terribly easy to do. And probably as delta X changes, we might have to worry about the fact that the pressure might change too. So it's not nearly so simple. If this was complicated, then this is going to be really complicated, right? But we can start to think about things mathematically and maybe come up with an easy way to represent this. And so let's go back to our equation where we have work is equal to F times delta X. Okay, so now work or delta X is easy, but F isn't, and we haven't found out any way to include any kind of this pressure stuff that we've been talking about. But the key insight here is to say, well, look, there's an area. Our piston has a cross-sectional area, right? So if it's round, it's going to be some area of that piston. And so I can always multiply by 1, right? I mean, there's no harm in multiplying by 1. And so I can multiply this expression by area over area. Nobody disagrees with that, right? And now I can do some algebraic rearrangement. Okay, everybody still okay with me? I'm not breaking any laws of math, am I? Okay, so I've just taken one of those A's and moved it down here, and I moved another A over here. Okay, so now that we've sort of highlighted what we might think might happen, does this look familiar to anybody? Yes, so pressure is force per unit area. So when you talk about the pressure in your tires, you're talking about pounds per square inch, right? So newtons per square meter, it's the same thing. So this is pressure. Okay. What's this? This is a little harder. So if I take a constant area, suppose I take a sphere, or a, no, not a sphere, but a disk, and I have it move from point A to point B, is that's no longer an area, right? That's a volume, right? So the volume, or the change in volume, is going to be equal to the area, which stays constant, times the displacement. So remember, volume is length times width times height. Well, area already includes length times width, right? It's like pi r squared. And then this is like height. So essentially this equation is, we've transferred our work equation from force times displacement to pressure times delta V, or times change in volume. Okay, and so this is a convenient equation, but now we need to think, what's our sign convention need to be for this? So suppose that this is our system, the inside of the cylinder is our system, and it has to do work against the external pressure. So what would our sign be, positive or negative in that case? It has to be negative, right? Because the system is doing work to the surroundings. So if it's pushing against the outside atmosphere, it's doing work to the surroundings. And so in this case, we know that our sign is going to be negative. And for any type of situation, I mean, you can almost guarantee that if your system is is the gas inside the cylinder, you can pretty much memorize the fact that the work done on the surroundings is going to be negative. So negative pressure times delta V. Now obviously if delta V is if the system is contracting, so if delta V is negative, we're making the system smaller, then you can end up with a situation where you have two negatives and it makes a positive. But when you're memorizing an equation, you want to memorize the form where this starts out with a negative sign.
Can we just work it like without negatives and then inside surrounding system surrounding and above the sun that
way? In principle, if you were that good, yes. But I guarantee if that's the approach that you take, as a budding thermodynamicist, you're bound to make a mistake your first couple times, just as we all do. And so I think it's always a good idea at the end of a problem to say, does this sign make sense? But the approach where you say,
I'm just going to forget about the sign and apply it at the end based on what I think makes sense, might not always be the best approach, because you could end up with a situation where it might be working against your intuition. Okay? Particularly when we start thinking about heat and work, then there could be situations where, you know, it might rapidly expand and then get colder at the same time, and so it could be counterintuitive depending on what's happening.
Okay, but this is the general form of our expression for work done by a gas and a piston. Now, I hate to bring in the calculus, but a lot of times it's going to be necessary not to think of this as just a big delta V, right? Because the pressure might actually change as you change delta V, and so there might be times when you have to think about a very, very small change in delta V, right? And so if we write work equals minus external pressure times change in volume, that assumes that the external pressure is constant and the change in volume is constant as well. It's a change, but there's nothing fancy about the change in volume. But there might be situations where you need to think about, and we'll look at these in more specific detail, where you might need to write PEX dV. Now, there's nothing magical about calculus, right? This is just saying that instead of taking the work from position A to position B, it makes perfect sense that if I take the work from position A to position B, that that would be equal to the sum of the work from position here to here, here to here, here to here, if I added up over all the little tiny motions from A to B, right? So in some sense, I could write dW1 plus dW2 plus dW3 is equal to minus PEX dV1 plus minus PEX dV2 plus, and so on. I can break it up into as many infinitesimally small motions as I want. That's all this is saying. This integral sign is meant to look like an S. It doesn't, but it means sum. And so basically you're summing up all of the pressures for every single change in volume, very small change in volume, and you're ending up with a total work that's being done by the gas and the cylinder. Okay, and so keep this equation in the back of your head. We'll definitely refer to it or get back to it here in a little bit. Okay, so there's more examples of work in your book. But, you know, this is sort of the basic two that we'll be getting on quite frequently. Okay.
Does the answer be yes?
What's?
If the answer is
zero.
If PEX is zero,
yes. If PEX is zero, yes. Yep. Yeah.
So on your drawing, you wrote like the internal pressure inside the cylinder. So does that matter? Like you wrote P's on the inside.
Right, well, it's assumed that the external pressure is all around.
Okay.
Right? Okay, so now we talked about work. The next thing we want to talk about is heat. Actually, I'll leave that up for a little bit. Okay, so heat is, again, originally it was postulated to exist. It wasn't necessarily, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I know what heat is. Heat was designed or intended to be the physical quantity which gives something a temperature. Okay, and so, again, thermodynamics originally didn't start out as a terribly, I mean, there was lots of observations going in, but it started out with postulates. Just like when people first started studying mathematics in detail, they started out with postulates and then they worked out theories from there. Okay, and so heat was a quantity that was postulated to relate to changes in temperature, and it was defined initially to have the same units as work. So it had this unit of energy, or a joule, or a calorie, or however you want to refer to it, but it had the same units as work. Okay, and so similarly, we have a convention. Okay, so if heat is positive, if the system absorbs it, okay, and if the system absorbs heat, then generally the temperature is going to increase. And so an absorbed heat means an increase in temperature. And heat is negative if it's emitted by the system or given off. And that's associated with a decrease in temperature. Okay, and so we're going to talk a little bit about the heat capacity next time. But when you're thinking about the relationship between the amount of heat absorbed or given off by a system and the actual temperature change that's observed, so 5 degrees, 10 degrees, whatever, the heat capacity is defined as the proportionality between heat and the change in temperature. Okay, and so this is an equation that may look familiar to you. We'll get to the details in a second. So a change in heat, so delta Q, just like we have delta work, where that would be a change in the amount of work done, would be equal to the heat capacity represented simply by C for now, times delta T. And similarly, you could write, just doing some algebraic rearrangement, C is equal to the change in the heat divided by the change in the temperature. Now, if that looks suspiciously like a derivative, your suspicions would be correct. And again, we're going to try to hide from you as much calculus as we can, but when the definition is a derivative, then you almost have to give some nod to calculus. So if you think about how easy it is to change an object's temperature, right? You can start out here where we imagine that we have a curve. Let's suppose we have this red curve. Okay, if I absorb a certain amount of heat, that corresponds to a change in temperature from, you know, say point A to point B, right? And so essentially what the heat capacity is telling me is how much heat do I observe that goes along with the change in the temperature. And so something with a very high heat capacity, I'm going to absorb a lot of heat. So you can see I can absorb a lot of heat, but have a very modest change in temperature from this position to this position. Would be a modest change in temperature, but I've absorbed a lot of heat. Whereas in this case, let's go back to the red curve, if I absorb a lot of heat, if I want to go from point A to point B, now I have a correspondingly high change in temperature. Okay, and so high heat capacities mean that you can absorb lots of heat without changing your temperature that much. Low heat capacity means you add a little bit of heat and you have a fairly big change in temperature. And so in that sense, if you think back to your definition of a buffer, right? A buffer is intended to resist the change of protons. So you add protons and the buffer is intended to resist the change in pH, right? So in this sense, a heat capacity is a little bit like a buffer. I'm adding heat, and something with a high heat capacity is going to resist the temptation, or whatever you want to call it, to change temperature. Okay, and so there's a relationship. I mean, there's no Michaelis constant or Michaelis-Menten equation, or no, Henderson-Hasselbalch equation for buffer or heat capacities, but the concept is similar. It has to do with how much heat you absorb versus how much your temperature actually changes. Okay, and so we can, you know, again, introducing the brutal form of calculus, if heat capacity really is a derivative like this, change in Q over change in temperature, then, again, I'm not going to go into the details of what an actual integral or what a derivative is, but that's essentially what we're looking at. And if we're looking at an actual derivative, then we can do the same kind of thing. Remember our first law of calculus. An integration is the inverse operation of a derivation. And so if we have a derivative, we can always integrate it to get a real quantity. And so that's what this slide is trying to show. But really what we're interested in showing here, or what we can demonstrate, okay, so if I have C is equal to dQ dt, again, remember that these little d's, all they are just small changes. So I can move them around like any, I mean, I could make these deltas and it would be the same type of a thing. And so I could just as easily write dQ is equal to C dt, and if I multiply one side by 5 and multiply the other side by 5, that's valid, right? If I integrate them over the same limits, that's also valid. I'm basically just doing the same thing to both sides. So it's always okay to do the same mathematical operation on one side as it is to the other. And so I can integrate from some unknown Q1 to Q2. I can integrate from some temperature 1 to temperature 2. If the C is constant, that is, it doesn't change, right? So I can bring that outside the integral. What's the value of that exact integral? It's very easy. I'll give you a hint.
It's like the same, like T2 to T1 stands change in T. Like,
yeah, so, but what's, if you were given that problem on a math test?
I don't know, that's a long time. Like 1 or 0, it would be like C times T2 minus T1.
Exactly. So this is just, it's like integrating dx, right? So the integral of dx is x. And so you take your upper bound of T2 minus your lower bound of T1, and you get C times T2 minus T1. You can always write this. I mean, this is just the difference in temperature, right? So we get C times delta T. Again, this is the same kind of thing. We're just integrating dx. And so here we're getting Q2 minus Q1. Which is delta Q. And if we put it all together, we get delta Q is equal to C times delta T. And so essentially, we've derived our derivation back, or our definition back here. But this is meant to show you that when you think about the equation that you used in Chem 2 or Gen Chem 2, you were thinking about the heat is equal to the heat capacity times delta T. Well, now, heat capacity, you were often thinking of it as heat capacity per gram, right? So that's the specific heat capacity, which we write in this class as C star. Okay, so the heat capacity overall would be heat capacity per gram
multiplied by the number of grams, right? And that would give you Q is equal to MC delta T. And so we're a little bit of unfamiliar territory on how we got there, but hopefully this equation looks a little bit familiar to you from your Chem 1 days, or Chem 2 days. Anyway, so we'll keep doing this. We'll work on this a little bit. Let's see. So let's look at our equation here. Let's go back to our simple one where we just envision our heat capacity as just a constant number for a particular system. So if temperature goes up, does that make sense for our system? So if the temperature of the system goes up, so delta T is positive, does that make sense for delta Q?
It makes sense for if you go up, you mean?
Yeah.
The system is absorbing heat, right? And so we would expect that the temperature would go up. If the temperature goes down and delta T is negative, what's the sign of delta Q?
Negative,
right? So heat capacity is always a positive number. And so when we think about what makes sense in terms of our convention, this makes sense from our convention. A positive heat corresponds to a positive temperature change. A negative heat corresponds to a negative temperature change. We've gotten some theoretical background. Now we have to take in and put in some of our actual practical observations, right? So postulates of thermodynamics can get you so far, but now we need to realize that, okay, when we actually want to measure the heat capacity of a system or a real molecule, what is it telling us? And so, as you probably well know from your Chem 2, is that the heat capacity will depend on whether you're measuring the system at a constant volume situation or a constant pressure situation. We'll look at specific examples here in the coming lectures, but that's where you have your heat capacity, Cp versus Cv. For a solid or for a liquid, you know, it really doesn't matter whether you have constant volume or constant pressure, right? I mean, if I have a piece of steel, and I put that piece of steel on the desk, and I put a very high pressure around it to make sure that the volume stays the same, but the pressure might increase. The amount of heat absorbed, I mean, the change in the volume of your system is going to be so small that to a first approximation, your Cp is going to be equal to your Cv. Okay, so for solids and for liquids, generally that holds to be true. And if we look at our water, we can see that water, the heat capacity at constant pressure, is almost equal to the heat capacity at constant volume. For ice, the heat capacity is you know equal to the hundredths place, right? And so for solids and liquids, the heat capacities are approximately equal. For gas, that's where things start to get interesting. And so real materials have real different properties. I mean, the heat capacity of water is going to be very different from the heat capacity of methane liquid or toluene or liquid benzene or something like that. But to a first approximation, all materials have a similar Cp and Cv for their solid state and for their liquid state. And I think we're going to stop there because I think this is a good stopping point. But what you should do for Thursday's lecture is think about this issue that we were talking about here. So again, if I have a small object, suppose I have a marble, how much heat do you think that's going to be able to absorb before seeing a change in temperature of 1 degree Celsius? And then think about if I have a big boulder of the same material, how much heat do you think that's going to be able to absorb before changing a degree in 1 degree Celsius? Hopefully what you're realizing is that something that's small is going to have a smaller heat capacity overall, but something that's quite big is going to have a big heat capacity. And we'll talk about that. You guys can bring me an answer when we get back. So think of that as your question of the day. We'll talk about this next time as well.